Efforts to deport criminal illegals is causing controversy, particularly among Catholic relief organizations and the U.S. bishops. Archbishop Thomas Wenske of the USCCB's Committee on Migration is here to weigh in. Later, the Papal Posse Live. Robert Royal, Father Gerald Murray, and I did a live event in D.C., and we discussed the Pope's new autobiography and much more. And Academy Award-winning director Mel Gibson talks about his new film, Flight Risk, the number one movie in America, and his plan for the resurrection the world over. Begins right now.
Now, Raymond Arroyo.
A warm welcome to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over. An important show for you tonight. If you'd like to comment, send me an X post. I'm at Raymond Arroyo and at Arroyo Grande on YouTube. First, some tragic news. There are no survivors following the collision of an American Airlines regional jet and a military helicopter at Reagan National Airport in Washington, D.C. There were 64 passengers and crew on the American Airlines flight, among them figure skaters, coaches, and their families. The Department of Defense says the military helicopter flight was a routine training mission with a crew of three. An investigation into the cause of the collision is underway. Pope Francis sent his condolences and prayers. We ask you to keep all those who lost their lives and their families in your prayers. And President Trump signed a number of executive orders in his first hours in office, many of them dealing directly with the border crisis and illegal immigration. They include realigning the refugee program, declaring a national emergency at the border, and ending so-called birthright citizenship. Deportations of criminal illegal aliens have already begun. But these actions have not been without controversy, garnering a reaction from the U.S. Catholic bishops and several Catholic NGOs. Is the Trump administration acting within its rights in order to protect the U.S. homeland, or are these actions immoral? For answers, we're joined by a member of the USCCB's Committee on Migration and Refugee Services, Archbishop of Miami, Thomas Wenske. Your Excellency, thank you for being here. Welcome back to the program. The tension between the U.S. bishops and the Trump administration really spiked after Vice President J.D. Vance, a Catholic, was critical of the U.S. bishops on CBS's Face the Nation. Watch.
The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops this week condemned some of the executive orders signed by President Trump, specifically those allowing immigration and customs enforcement to enter churches and to enter schools. Do you personally support the idea of conducting a raid or enforcement action in a church service, at a school?
As a practicing Catholic, I was actually heartbroken by that statement. And I think that the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops needs to actually look in the mirror a little bit and recognize that when they receive over $100 million to help resettle illegal immigrants, are they worried about humanitarian concerns or are they actually worried about their bottom line? We are going to enforce immigration law. We're going to protect the American people.
Archbishop Wenske, Cardinal Dolan called those comments by the vice president nasty and scurrilous. But isn't this a prudential judgment entrusted to duly elected authorities in this case?
Well, certainly they do have the prudential judgment to enforce, and it's their obligation to enforce the laws of the land. How they do it, or the spirit in which they do it, should be one that promotes the common good and does not create more harm than good in the process of implementing the laws. So. And I think the vice president was a bit off the mark when alleging that we've gotten $100 million to resettle illegal aliens. First of all, we've gotten we participated for over since the end of World War II with the U.S. government in helping to resettle refugees. And refugees, by definition, are not illegal aliens. They're people that have been admitted to this country by the United States under the Refugee Act, and the U.S. government has contracted with the Catholics and also with Jewish organizations and other Protestant organizations to help resettle these people, because the government knows that when nonprofits, when faith-based organizations do this work, they do it much more efficiently and much more economically than the government. And again, it's not government money that we're receiving, it's our money, because, you know, the government doesn't have any money, it's taxpayer money, and we're taxpayers as Catholics in this country.
Earlier this week, the conference issued a statement very quickly addressing this long-standing partnership that you referenced with the federal government, and you know, they make the case that though they receive a large portion of the USCCB migration program money from the government, it doesn't cover everything. Here's a quote. Every person resettled through USRAP is vetted and approved for the program by the federal government while outside the United States. In our agreements with the government, the USCCB receives funds to do this work. However, these funds are not sufficient to cover the entire cost of the program. Your Excellency, that, look, people are open to that. They're certainly hearing that. But I want to play something and get your reaction to this. This is Catholic Charities of Milwaukee, the Archdiocese of Milwaukee, coaching immigrants about what they should do should immigration authorities appear at their workplace or homes. Watch.
First, do not panic and do not run away. Two, you have the right to remain silent. You do not need to speak to the immigration authorities or answer any questions. Third, you have the right to speak to a lawyer. If you are detained or taken into custody, you have the right to immediately contact a lawyer.
Archbishop, the question this raises is, why is Catholic Charities advising illegal aliens on how to evade law enforcement? That's certainly what that sounds like.
Well, I don't think it's how to evade law enforcement. The first thing they told them is not to flee, not to run away. But they also said that they have certain rights, and basically they're educating people to know their rights so that they're not their rights are not abused. So I think the first thing they said was, don't run away, and know your rights so that you can get the proper representation that you need, so that if you have a case to make, you can make that case and not be railroaded on spurious reasons.
Mm-hmm. Your Excellency, there have been reports that Catholic NGOs were granted as much as $2.9 billion in migration-related funding over the past 4 years of the Biden administration. I mean, Catholic Charities of Houston alone reportedly received $500 million in those taxpayer funds, which goes to migrants for cars and rent and housing and food. Because so many of the dioceses have their own independent migration offices, the funds are difficult to track. My question is, can you see how the average American Catholic might be distressed at how the government and their funds are working with the church to prioritize illegal aliens over our own citizens?
Again, if the government has given this money to the various Catholic charities organizations, they're giving this money to carry out services on behalf of the government for people that the government has allowed into the country. These are not getaways that are the beneficiaries of this government money or this taxpayer money. These are people that have been paroled into the country, and with the understanding that they're going to apply for asylum, et cetera. Now, you know, that the prior administration's policy perhaps encouraged people that would come across the country that did not have a bona fide case to make. That is another argument. But if the government has these people and they say, I need help, and they ask the church, can you help? We help.
Well, but Archbishop, look, I was down in Brownsville, Texas, and they have a huge Catholic Charities, a receiving center there. And these are people who just come across. I mean, I watched them at 3 a.m. I was embedded. I watched the folks being brought across by the cartels by the hundreds. They're put in buses and they're brought to Catholic Charities, who basically give them a manila folder and an airline ticket to go wherever they wanted in the United States. That seems to be facilitating, I would argue, the extension of the cartels and their actions, rather than just doing refugee work. These are two separate things, and I think the funds have all been bundled together here.
In that case, your argument is not with the Catholic Charities that are trying to fulfill the corporal and spiritual works of mercy. Your argument is with the government and their their failed policies, if you will, on the border. But once these people are here, you know, you're going to let them on, leave them on a street corner to starve to death. That would be according to what we hold as our commitment to serve those who we should recognize as recognize Jesus in their face.
Archbishop, the Catechism of the Catholic Church teaches, and I'm going to quote this, the more prosperous nations are obliged to the extent they are able to welcome the foreigner in search of the security and means of livelihood. Political authorities, for the sake of the common good for which they are responsible, may make the exercise of the right to immigrate subject to various juridical conditions, especially with regards to the immigrant's duties toward their country of adoption. And, you know, when you read that, doesn't the government have a right to regulate immigration, particularly when it comes to individuals who are known to be criminal dangers, Your Excellency, who are violating not only the immigration law, but have a criminal record?
Of course, and we have no argument with that at all. And, you know, from the Catechism of the Church has a long history. Pius XII said in Ex Familias that, you know, people have a right, because they're human beings, they have a right to conditions worthy of human life. Everybody has a right to live in conditions of human life. But if a person cannot secure those conditions in the place where he is, in the country where he happens to be, where he was born, then he has the right to seek those conditions elsewhere. And the United States has been a welcoming country with the spirit of what is written in the Catechism over the centuries. We are a nation of immigrants. We have and welcomed millions of immigrants.
Archbishop, nobody's questioning that. We accept more immigrants than any other nation in the world, which is why it is a bit befuddling when you read, you know, comments from the bishops' conference, and I've gotten so many emails from Catholics this week saying, why are the bishops crying out for the human dignity of criminals? I mean, the Trump administration is deporting criminal aliens. Why is that such a bad thing?
And I don't think there's an argument about that right now. And we're just making sure that we do it with the proper dignity and within the color of law as well. And there's no argument about that. You mentioned earlier something about birthright citizenship and talking about how the United States has welcomed so many immigrants. One of the best things that we have in this country is birthright citizenship, because that is the one thing that helps to integrate people into this country very quickly. Because we all have, you know, great stories about, you know, that first generation American that has made it because of the sacrifices of his parents that came to this country looking for greater opportunities for them. We want people, if they're in this country, to become Americans as quickly as possible and to become participants of this great nation.
Yeah, but there needs to be an orderly process, Archbishop, and I think that's what the attempt now is, to create an orderly process. You can't just have everybody running. All the people you mentioned came in, they got, like my father, you know, he waited 8 years, he needed a sponsor, and then he served in the military. So he became an American through desire and then proved himself. But the nation doesn't have an obligation to throw open its doors to everybody and then welcome whatever children you have. The 14th Amendment, I mean, just for clarification, and correct me if I'm wrong, 14th Amendment was created because of the free slaves, and so that they could feel fully part of the American process and experience. That's what it was created for.
It took a long time before that happened, that the 14th Amendment was honored in reality in this country. Mm-hmm. But the 14th Amendment talks about people that are, you know, that if they're under the jurisdiction of the United States, they have birthright citizenship.
Archbishop, Pope Francis spoke out on this issue of Trump's mass deportations on January 19th, a day before he was sworn in. He was asked by a reporter what the Pope thought of the policy. He said this: if true, this will be a disgrace because it makes the poor wretches who have nothing pay the bill for the imbalance. This won't do. This is not the way to solve things. This is not how things are resolved.
I think the qualification on that is important, if true, he says. Now, you know, this past weekend we had a big to-do, a lot of drama about the deportation of some Colombians back to Colombia, with the president of Colombia saying, no, they can't come, and then he backtracked right. And said they could. That was two planes of about 80 Colombians in each plane that were deported back to Colombia, and they are back in Colombia today. Do you know how many Colombians were deported in December by the Biden administration? 300.
Well, I mean, but is that a bad thing?
No, it's not a bad thing. I'm just saying that, you know, maybe this mass deportation that everybody is feared about is not as massive as people are thinking.
Cardinal McElroy of the Washington Archdiocese said, quote, wider indiscriminate massive deportation across the country would be something that would be incompatible with Catholic doctrine. And I guess the big question is, we're talking about criminal aliens being removed from the country. Is that in any way incompatible with Catholic doctrine, Your Excellency?
Well, you know, and I don't think Cardinal McElroy was speaking about criminal aliens. He was talking about a wider sense of deportation. And again, President Trump has, you know, promised to get control of the border, and I think he's going to be successful at doing that. And I think policy-wise, that's a good thing, to get control of the border. But he also has promised us the greatest economy ever, that we're going to have the most prosperous economy we ever had. And that's a great promise. But if he's going to be able to keep that promise, he's going to have to make an accommodation on migration, because you're not going to have the best economy ever without immigrants, because immigrants are part of this economy. They're needed for the economy. And therefore, get rid of the bad guys, the bad actors. Okay, if you have to get rid of them, get rid of them. Hopefully, they're not going to we're not going to destabilize other countries because we've gotten rid of them. But after we got rid of those bad guys or taken care of them, then let's look at some way of honoring the people that have been here for years and have worked hard and not gotten into trouble, that have paid taxes, et cetera.
Your Excellency, with all due respect, it seems we're asking the American taxpayer and the American administration to do what the Holy See won't do. The Holy See just promulgated laws that if you violate their border, if you cross the border illegally of the Vatican, the Holy See state, you are subject to 4 to 5 year jail sentences. So why can't we apply that to the United States? I just don't see why the American taxpayer is always the one who has to sort of bear the burden for citizens that refuse to get in line and follow an orderly process of immigration as set forth by the country itself.
Well, again, a lot of people are fleeing, desperate conditions. Look at Nicaragua, where there's an active persecution of the church, four bishops exiled, a diocese that has lost almost all their priests through exile by the government that not only throws them out of the country, but revokes their citizenship. These people are here in this country, many of them on TPS that hasn't been renewed or is soon to be expired. To send them back to Nicaragua this time would be like sending them back into a burning building.
I agree with you, Your Excellency. That's a case of actual refugee status that should be extended to those people. But let's face it, there are a lot of economic refugees that have been accepted that shouldn't have been.
Right. Well, look at the situation in Venezuela. You know, Venezuela has lost 20% of its population because of the dictatorship of Maduro. It's a left-wing dictatorship, and it's... That left-wing dictatorship has ruined its economy, so people are running for political reasons and partly for economic reasons as well. But they come and they can be not a problem to us, but a resource for us, an opportunity for us, as immigrants have always.
Look, I want to move on to this. President Trump signed into law the Laken Riley Act this week, so-called for that Georgia nursing student murdered by an illegal alien last year. The law expands the reach of federal law enforcement to arrest, detain, and deport criminal aliens. This is Laken Riley's mother.
He said he would secure our borders and that he would never forget about Laken. And he hasn't.
He's a man of his word. We trust that he will fight for the American people. Most importantly, I want to thank our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, because without his sacrifices, Lakin's story would have ended on that horrific day that she was taken from us.
There are countless other examples, Your Excellency, of Americans who have been killed and assaulted, even raped by criminal illegal immigrants, trafficking kids, raping women, slaying Americans. And look, I know that's not unique to illegal aliens. Americans do it too. But why add to the trouble, if you will? Your thoughts on Lakin Riley's mother's testimony there?
No, I cannot fault her testimony. It's very moving. And actually, I think the perpetrator was released by, he should have been in jail, and he was released by some, if it wasn't the immigration authorities, it was a local jail that let him go. So not every immigrant that comes across the border is a white dove, but not everyone is a criminal or a gangster or somebody intent on doing harm. Many people that come here just seeking the possibility of life, they're seeking the conditions worthy of human life, that as human beings they have a right to. It's their God-given right to live in conditions worthy of human life.
Your Excellency, isn't the government's first responsibility to American citizens and their safety under the law to make sure that these criminal offenders aren't coming into the United States, and frankly, that no one is breaking the law, including immigrants?
Nobody should break the law. Everybody should honor the law. But again, you have to remember the case of that Bishop Muriel in that novel of Victor Hugo, Les Miserables. The protagonist was pursued by an inspector because he stole a loaf of bread, and the bishop was able to look over that failure and give him a chance at life, as Jesus said, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. Laws are meant to enhance human flourishing, not to harm human flourishing. A lot of these illegal aliens or illegal migrants or whatever you want to call them, it's not so much that they're breaking the law as the law is breaking them, because there is no system or no procedure for them to regulate their status. We have a broken asylum system where it takes an inordinate amount of time to process an asylum case.
Well, I think you're right, Archbishop. This is why we need an orderly process, though, which we don't have now because the borders were thrown open for so long.
Well, let's work on creating those orderly processes. And what I was talking about earlier, the updating of the registry date would be part of that orderly process, because it would open the doors for people that have been here for a long time that are needed here because our economy needs them. But at the same time, it would require that they would show good moral character, so we would make sure we would not, admit any bad actors in that case. And that would be a way of providing an orderly process that would benefit not only the migrant, but the rest of the American society.
Your Excellency, Archbishop Thomas Wensky, thank you for being here. Thank you for the time. We'll check in the days ahead, and we will continue to cover all sides of this immigration issue, as we have for decades, in the week ahead. Thank you. It is not often that the Papal Posse escapes the confines of a TV studio, but we recently assembled at the 25th anniversary of Robert Royal's Faith and Reason Institute in Washington, D.C. Bob and Priest of the Archdiocese of New York, Father Gerald Murray, and yours truly, made a special appearance with an audience Q&A, and we hit some topics of interest. Here is the Papal Posse live. Let's open it up to questions.
Okay, what I most enjoy about your show is the commentary on current events. So I'm going to be a little provocative, but what do you have to say about the Pope saying that Donald Trump is a disgrace for deporting illegal immigrants this week. This is sort of the typical fodder, I think, of the papal posse, so I'm going to leave it there.
Thanks for getting us in trouble, Ma. As some of you might have noted, the Pope, following Cardinal McElroy's pronouncement, said that the rounding up of criminal aliens, illegal aliens, undocumented aliens, is a disgrace. Who should be the first victim? You will be. Go ahead, Father. Your thought on this.
Sure. The papacy has its political stance as regards its relations to nations, and this is a manifestation of it. And they've taken a stance that once those who are in a country have established themselves here, it's wrong to evict them in general. The Holy See contradicted that in December when the Vatican City State issued laws providing for jail terms for those who illegally enter. So you can say to yourself, political performative speech to prove liberal bona fides conflicts with the fact that if 1,000 ex-countrymen stormed through the Swiss Guard gate to the right, to the left, as you're looking at St. Peter's, and went up the hill and where St. Pope Benedict was living and established a tent city up there, they would be thrown out. I see no reason why other countries can't do the same thing.
And that was literally last week. 5-year jail terms, fines for anybody broaching the borders of the Vatican. Well, if the Vatican can patrol its borders with a wall that's been there for hundreds of years, surely we can, Bob.
You know, we get a lot of pushback from Orthodox Catholics, too, about criticizing statements like that. But it's simply the case, if you think about it for 2 seconds, that any country has got to be able to control its borders and actually control the people who are already inside of it. Now, I'm a little softer probably than my colleagues here about at least people who've been here a long time, in that I feel like the United States then has a moral obligation after people have been here 10, 20 years. We've committed an error or two, and then we've got to kind of negotiate this. Reagan used to talk about this way. But what I would say is this. There are some issues. The Pope is not the most rigorous speaker about some of these contentious issues. I mean, you see how he's gotten himself into trouble in Israel. He says that war is always a defeat. Well, it isn't. You know, there are times when, unfortunately, because of the fallen nature of the world and sinners are in the world, that there has to be a violent, I would say the use of force, not necessarily violence, the use of force to repel evil people. And I think that in this case of the immigration, that our bishops, the Vatican largely, and many religious figures in Europe as well, haven't understood the threat. You know, we're America. We love immigrants who come here legally and bring their energies and their talents and even the cultures that they come from. But there's a limit to what any country can absorb. And to just think that anybody who wants to show up at the border here has a virtual right, almost a divine right, to enter and to stay, it just seems to me to be unrealistic. Now, we're lucky in the United States that most of the people, I don't say all, but most of the people who are crossing our border in Mexico are either evangelical or Catholic. In Europe, where these large waves, millions, hundreds of thousands, and even millions of people who are Muslim are arriving, I mean, you see it as much as we do, too. You see these massive demonstrations in London and things that happen in Germany and in France, and they make a country ungovernable. So it isn't as if it's just hard-heartedness and people are it's a disgrace that people want to control their borders. It's if we're seeking the common good within a country, there's going to have to be some kind of control and recognition of what limits there are to not harming your own culture as you're trying to help other people.
Yes, ma'am, in the front.
So yesterday in the Diocese of Arlington, there was hope. Because our good bishop, Michael F. Burbidge, issued a pastoral letter on the indignity of IVF and the importance of the need to recognize that every party in the IVF process is degraded and debased and disrespected. So I would propose to you good gentlemen, two of whom I know rather well, that there is hope, and that just because it seems like everything that is the beautiful 2,000-year tradition of our church is somehow a dirty word now, I would propose that the pendulum is swinging the other way.
You want to comment on that?
Yeah, this reminds me of something that I often say when I'm giving lectures somewhere that I think is absolutely crucial for us to remember, because it can look very bad, right? And when you walk out, it can look very bad in America in a variety of ways. But think about this. When the Soviet Union fell, it still had all its weapons. Yeah, over 10,000 nuclear weapons, huge army, tanks, guns, all that stuff. Right? And yet it fell. And nobody knew that it was going to fall. Not the CIA, you know, not the FBI, not the international community. Nobody. John Paul knew. Ronald Reagan knew. And I think Margaret Thatcher knew. So the three of them did what they could do. And I always loved Reagan was asked one time what he wanted, and he said, "We win, they lose." It's that simple. You know? But if you keep that clear in your mind, you never know. If the Soviet Union can fall with 12,000 nuclear weapons, who knows what can happen in God's time? Mm-hmm. So we stay at it. Even if it seems hopeless, even if it seems like we're outnumbered and the entire culture is against us. But nobody knows the day or the hour that thing might fall.
No, that's great. I mean, I think of St. Bernadette, a girl in an obscure corner of France, and now it's a shrine that millions of people go to every year from all over the world for the purpose of praying to the Mother of God and asking blessings from the Eucharistic Lord. So God has much in store that we don't know, and we just have to stand by. Well, Raymond wrote the books on Mother Angelica. If you ever told me an Italian woman from Ohio is going to start a convent in Alabama and can become the head leader of the biggest worldwide Catholic enterprise in news, culture, and religion, I don't know that any other religion even has anything like it. I mean, this is the world leader, and why is it? Because your great friend, Mother A, said, "I'm going to do something."
Yeah. No, she lit a light in the darkness. There's always been darkness. There's always been confusion. And as she taught me so well, and I think we've all experienced, when you speak the truth, she used to always say, "Follow the truth wherever it leads." That's what you're here to do. Follow the truth wherever it leads. What she didn't tell me, but I watched her go through it, was when you tell the truth, you will get shot, stabbed, undermined, and abused from morning till night. But guess what? The first guy did as well. It's just part of the path. And there's almost joy in it. There's almost joy in it when you...
Well, wasn't she one of the happiest people you ever met?
She was, and she was in near constant pain, and, you know, there were always people throwing darts at her and criticizing her, but she kept that, you know, she had that inner glow, and even in death, people are still watching and following this woman, which is a remarkable thing, this simple girl, Rita Rizzo from Canton, Ohio, you know? God bless her. Want to do one more? Yes, sir.
You know, I listen to a lot of proclamations from the Pope, and a lot of them are very confusing to me, and I get questions about them. And the only thing that makes sense to me is that it's about his Marxist roots from South America, in specific, the Pope and the Marxism, how it's encroached into religion in general. Could somebody comment on Marxism and its effect on the church?
Pop, you wrote the book on Marxism.
I don't think exactly it's Marxism. There's some Marxist elements, but he's not consistent enough to kind of follow you know, a body of thought like that. And look, it's just his nature. In fact, he once said about Argentinians that Argentinians say one thing, think another, and do a third. And I don't know about my colleagues here, but after the last 12 years of trying to figure him out, I think that that probably explains things as much as anything does. But there's a lot of sentimentalism, which tends in a kind of a Marxist direction. I admit that. But there's a kind of, there's feeling in him that just isn't quite disciplined. I mean, I'll say this outright. I don't think it's intellect. It's the reason part of the faith isn't disciplined enough. And in fact, he tends to denigrate theological truth. Well, you just can't denigrate the truth. Remember a few years ago, they were saying in the Vatican, some people use truth as a weapon. Well, I mean, maybe we need to use the truth as a weapon, because after all, the truth is telling us what reality is.
Yeah, sword, you know? Of the spirit.
Yeah. I come with a sword to divide.
There's a funny, I read his new autobiography. The first half of it is about his youth in Argentina, and then it just jumps to his election in the papacy. So there's nothing in between about all those years that people have been wondering about for forever. But I just think that it's easy to recognize certain Marxist elements in what he talks about, but that's really not him. And he's actually talked against Marxism. Liberation theology, he said that the God's faithful people in Argentina didn't want Marxism or didn't want liberation theology. They wanted a populist Catholicism. And it's interesting that he understands populism of that kind. He doesn't seem to understand the kind of populism we have now in the United States and is growing in Europe. Because the people are feeling that their elites have not taken care of them. So there's no answer to what you're asking is essentially a question that the three of us have been trying to answer over the last 13 years.
Well, I will say, in contradistinction, that in an earlier book, it published a year ago.
Contradistinction? What the heck? You mean contradiction?
No, I'm trying to be nice.
Oh, okay.
No, the Pope's most influential teacher in his life was a communist woman who was, I believe, a biology teacher,
yes,
and who was executed by the military junta. But he wrote, or he said to the interviewer in a book published a year ago, she taught me how to think. Mm. It's there. I'm reading the new biography. The second chapter, the first basically two pages, is a Marxist analysis of how the economy works in the world, which is essentially the only reason rich people are rich is because poor people are poor.
Right.
Now, the Catholic Church has never said anything of the sort, and good economics doesn't believe that. The idea that rich people intentionally impoverish the poor because that's the only way they get wealth, it's the other way around. You enrich the customers so that they continue to buy your products, and then you can make more of them. Anyway, the problem here is sentimentality, though, because Marxist theory used by Catholics is basically trying to say the reason we have such social divisions in Latin America is because selfish people don't care for the poor. Mm. I'm not convinced of that. I think it largely has to do with education and also with basically corrupt governments that do not promote universal education. So this is a big problem. But your point is very good, because the average person who's not a Catholic, who hears the Pope make statements of that sort, says, you know, what does he want?
What's happened
Cuba?
To the church?
Yeah, is this Cuba? I mean, what are we doing here?
Yeah, well, and I mean, to reconcile both of my confreres here, and not to contravene or contradict.
Contradistinct.
I look at it as I always look at the personal and the biography, and it's those dark parts of the story, Bob, that where that biography does go into shadow that we don't know about. That, I think, is the real key to unlocking who Jorge Bergoglio is, because there is this thing, we've gotten dribs and drabs of it. He clearly had a tortured relationship with his father. The father made fun of him because he had flat feet and couldn't play soccer. He gravitated to mama and his grandmother, whom he constantly invokes when he talks about faith. And his father, remember, was an accountant. A man of, dare I say, rigor, rigidity. I see all those personal tremors that sort of live itself out through his papacy in the way he interprets certain things, the way he phrases certain things. So I don't think we can take it personally. I'm going to ask my own question before we go about how social media and the immediacy of the media has changed the way in which the church, dare I say, is synodal. All right now. I mean how the church interfaces with the rest of the world and the immediacy of the response and how they have to respond with more vigor and quickly.
Do you think they respond?
Yeah, I do. Not well, but they respond.
Yeah, I'm taken by how fast now the news cycle makes things disappear. Mm. In your city, Raymond, a man takes a truck and runs over 14 people. Who's talked about that?
Well, it's gone.
It's gone, right? Because yeah. We're off onto, deporting illegal aliens in Washington, D.C. Who remembers? I'm willing to say that maybe in a month, the L.A. fires, people are going to say, oh, yeah, that was last month. Paying attention to it. So it was Bill Clinton, I think, who discovered that if you wait a week, the news cycle goes around, and then it goes away. So you can say something that's controversial or that isn't. I think that the church, very often we seem to get different offices speaking across purposes with one another. And we've documented this a number of times on the show. So you're right that they know that they have to have that kind of immediacy, but I'm not so sure they're very good at it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Father, I think one of the amazing things is the public now knows these granular stories. They can see excerpts. And because of the explosion on social media, I just started a podcast, my Arroyo Grande podcast, and it's very interesting. The audience there is not the broadcast audience. It's different. These are people who are all in. They're very focused and committed. And they'll watch 2 hours of a broadcast. I can't make it for 10 minutes of a broadcast, but they're sitting through the 2 hours of these things, sometimes 3-hour Rogan interviews. But what this does is allow the public to deep dive into a topic that they're interested in at the click of a finger on their phones, wherever they are. And in the church context, that means they're instantly informed of things on a very deep level that otherwise it would have taken us months to figure out 20 years ago.
No, I think the phenomenon of instantaneous news across the entire globe has undermined the attempt always to control the narrative, as they say now, but also control the news. Mm-hmm. The reason why sex abuse among the clergy was so prevalent and wasn't destroyed because the bishops felt it was in their interest to hide it. And they were able to convince the media and the police to go along with it. That broke when essentially a reporter from the Boston Globe said, we got to get to this story, and the judge agreed. And I'm of the opinion the more information, the better, because as in free market economics, the wisdom of the mass of consumers will show you what product's worth buying and what's not. So in the religious sphere, when the Holy See controls all information about what the Holy See is doing, it's not healthy. And now they don't, because there's so much information that's instantly available, and you can compare notes. I'm always amazed, you've probably seen it, when the Pope does a video, you find there's a picture by Father Rupnik, the evil sexual molester priest who's still a priest for whatever reason. There's still a picture hanging in the Pope's study. Yeah. Now, in the old days, no one would know that, and apparently the Pope doesn't pay attention to the fact that people are going to see it. But now people ask questions, and the Holy See's put on the defensive, as they should be. Mm-hmm. Now, we have journalists in Rome who ask probing questions, and you just can't slough them off and say, we'll get back to you. Now, they still do it. But the immediacy of the answers, and videotape plays a great role. I always like it, Fox and other news networks, they go back to what the politician said 5 years ago, what he says today. In the church, it's the same thing. So I think that's all to the good.
Yeah, but there's not a lot of embarrassment about what...
Well, they want to kill the messenger or say they're doing the work of, the enemy.
Yeah.
Not that I'd know anything about that. All right, my friends, thank you all for having us. Ladies and gentlemen, the Papal Pontiff.
a very happy 25th anniversary to Robert Royal's Faith and Reason Institute. It was fun being there. Last week, I brought you a few moments from a conversation I had with Mel Gibson about the loss of his home in the L.A. wildfires and how the experience has prepared him even more to begin work on his sequel to The Passion of the Christ, The Resurrection. Well, tonight, I bring you an interview I did with Mel about his new thriller, Flight Risk, starring Mark Wahlberg. It's number one at the U.S. box office. And he discusses that long-anticipated sequel to The Passion. Here's my exclusive interview with Mel Gibson.
I never flew a fugitive before.
Government witness, not a fugitive.
Ready to go?
Is it always this bumpy?
You get used to it. Moretti is very disappointed in you, and he wants you dead.
Oh, shit.
Ah! Enemy!
We've been compromised.
Tell me how to fly this thing.
Pay attention. This is the good part.
Damn it!
I'm gonna enjoy this.
You ever see a face turn this color before? Huh?
I'm gonna tear you apart. Y'all need a pilot?
In an age when people are turning in three-hour epics, you decide to do this tight thriller. Why?
Because I can't sit there that long. I'm getting old joints, and the seat actually turns my bum numb. So I have to, I can't deal with it. So I just making a film for an audience that doesn't want a numb butt.
So that's
it's
a
like
good start.
85 minutes without credits, guaranteed. But 85-minute tight little action thriller. It's what we need after all these hours-long epics.
Anytime the audience starts thinking about what do I have to do when I leave, you know you're in trouble. And I watched some of these epics over the last few months, and your eyes go dry, and you can feel the audience pulling away. But this is not that. This is a tight thriller, and we have not seen. You haven't really done one of these.
Not really.
A thriller like this.
No, and I saw the initial script, and it's just like, wow, that's got all the makings of a tight little thriller.
Yeah.
And so I said, let's go. And I sat with the writer, and we...
What did you ask him to change?
Oh, a bunch of stuff. Some character stuff, some story beats. It was already a good script, you know.
Yeah. Give us the through line. What happens here? There's a federal agent transporting a witness for a case.
That's right. He's going to testify against some, bigwigs and corruption and stuff like that. He wants to make a deal. He doesn't really want to get caught. He's trying to avoid being captured, but he gets caught at the beginning, and then he says, okay, I'll make a deal. Just don't hurt me, he's put on a plane from some remote area somewhere in Alaska where he's hiding out to fly him back. And it's like a 75-minute flight to hit the deck, and we find out on the journey that the pilot isn't who he says he is.
He has ulterior motives.
Yes, he does. His motives are not very
high-minded. And that's Mark Wahlberg, and we want to talk about that character in a little bit. But
yeah, Mark, insane.
It's a wild performance.
Mark is insane. He's that's in him someplace.
This is a very dark Mark Wahlberg.
Yeah.
Antic Mark Wahlberg that we really haven't seen very much of in recent days.
Yeah, frantic, antic, manic, deeply disturbed man who's like, wants you to think he's the normal one and that you need to adjust. But it's a good...
Who made the decision to shave poor Mark's hair? He's bald in the movie.
That's all Mark.
Really?
We were about to get shooting and I was really, excited to get going. And Mark said, I got an idea. I said, how about I do it like... where I'm wearing a rug and I'm bald. And I said, whoa, give me 24 hours to think about that, Mark. It's hilarious and kind of great, I think. I slept on it and I woke up and I said, that's genius.
It worked out.
It worked out great.
How long was this shoot, Mel? This is a very short shoot.
It was like 22 days. That's harrowing. But, this is the way films are made these days. And a lot of the young directors, and in fact, almost all directors, are put under this kind of pressure cooker thing. Like, you deliver and deliver quickly in 22 days because we ain't living in the same world anymore. And the question is, in that amount of time, can you deliver something of quality? Because filmmaking is a very intense and it requires a lot and requires a lot of time.
How much pre-production time did you have on this movie?
I don't know, 5-6 weeks.
The whole industry has really changed. I mean, they're requiring you all to turn in product with less and less time. How do you do that as a filmmaker, though, and not embarrass yourself?
Well, this is the trick. I think you have to, planning is essential. You have to know what you're doing to begin with. A lot of people don't.
Yeah.
And so you get less time, which means less money, or sometimes it's less money, which means even less time. And you have to try and achieve excellence given the... And these are right across the board in the industry now. They want it faster. They want it cheaper. They want it... And you know, economically, it's a smart thing. And there is an art to delivering something of quality at a, you know, a budget.
At a brisk pace.
At a budget, yeah.
How do you plan that as a filmmaker? Where do you go to say, this is what we're leaving in, this is what needs to go with the time I have on hand?
No, absolutely. And you have to be thinking way ahead. I mean, there's the edit. The edit is the a great editor who actually worked on this.
Yeah, yeah.
His name is Steve Rosenblum.
Who also edited Braveheart.
Braveheart, yes. And he said to me one time, the edit is the final rewrite. And I thought, oh, that's brilliant. He's right. And how do we maximize time, money, effort? We make those edits beforehand because there's a rewrite. So you make as many edits as you can, and you restrict what you absolutely need. And because there's a lot of waste, time is money. Money is, you know, it's like so.
Sure, you really only shoot what you need. You don't do a lot
pretty
of excessive
much.
Shooting. And
not a lot of fat there.
But the constraints of this had to give you pause, Mel, at the beginning.
Sure.
This 90% of this movie is in the hull of a plane.
Yes.
A little plane.
That's right. It's a Cessna 208.
How did that change, A, your approach to this, and what you thought you could do there? How did you prep for that?
Sure. Well, you're confined. Not all the time. The beginning is open, the end is open, and, you know, you've got outside the plane, which is phenomenal vistas over the Alaskan Alps. So, you know, you've got all this going on, but you find that the canvas that you've got is much smaller, so you have to use finer strokes, and you have to make it epic given what you've got. And I think, I think we pulled it off.
I think you did. I mean, it's an amazing... This thing keeps topping itself. I mean, it moves, it moves, it moves, it tops. But I was stunned when you told me how tight that plane was. You bought a buck. You basically bought a piece of a plane.
Yeah, I bought a real aircraft, and you know that was not in service anymore, of course. And you used the inside of it. We had I think it was 5'7" wide by 4.5 feet tall. Three characters. Some big, you know, Mark's a big guy.
Yeah.
Michelle's, you know, she's a tall and slender waif of a thing, and Topher, of course. So there's these three actors working in this confined space with camera guys, sound, light, everything, and so one has to be judicious about the shot list, and you have to shoot as diversely and as new in every setup as you possibly can.
Why not shoot in a bigger aircraft?
Because I kind of like the idea of claustrophobia, and that these people are trapped in this little, you know,
they can't get away from each other. It's
it's a death trap over this wilderness
almost
of the
there.
Alaskan Alps. If they even if they survive the crash, they'll get eaten by a polar bear. You know,
tell me, did you storyboard this? You had to lay this out visually.
Yeah, a little bit, but I think the best indication of what gave us the best indication of where to go and how to do it was to actually get inside the space itself and, you know, set up camera angles with doubles and stuff like that to find out, wow, what works, what doesn't. And, it was just a very informative exercise that's better than storyboards.
Yeah.
I mean, there's only so many things you can do in that space.
Mm.
But we did all of them.
Incredible.
Whatever we could think of.
You know, as I watch this, and I mean, I see it in all your films. I mean, even Apocalypto, even The Passion. Humor is really the superpower of Mel Gibson as a director. You find these human moments of levity to break the rhythm, if you will, and reset the whole thing.
Absolutely. You have to undercut a lot of the heavier stuff with some stuff that is relatable, because as soon as you see behaviors that you are familiar with that you can relate to, they're instantly kind of charming and amusing. And all the characters found those little moments. Yeah. And of course, you know, we devised some so that there were little breaks in the momentum of, like, what should be the flow. It's just all of a sudden you're going down some weird side street of, like, bizarre, you know, kind of, which is like, kind of like, it always amuses me when I see things like that. And I've seen films that do that very well. Mm-hmm. There's some very many, you know.
Yeah.
And
well, this was Hitchcock would do it too. He'd have little,
oh yeah,
his, you know, hilarious.
Hitchcock
little
was never serious. He was like, he was tongue in cheek about the whole thing.
Exactly,
you know?
Right. This plays almost like old great thrillers. Mm-hmm. It is like a morality play in some ways. Was there any appeal in that to you? That justice is served.
Justice gets served. You know, people with flaws. They're, you know, they learn something. You know, and it, essentially, I think it's kind of like a buddy movie. Between
Why?
Two of the protagonists.
Why do you say that?
Well, they, you know, they start off at odds. They couldn't be more different or apart in their philosophies or in their character. And they don't like each other much. And when presented with an adverse situation, they have to become a team. They have to do it. Or they're not going to make it. So yeah. There's this kind of like, and it's got a good emotional underpinning too, which is nice. You
yeah.
Know? So
No. The movie play. I mean, it plays on multiple levels, and again, it's tight.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe how quick the movie went.
Oh yeah, you're out of there. You're like, hey, what happened? Is that over? Yeah, great.
What do you want people to take away from the film?
Entertainment, man. Just like have fun, and if there is a moment where you get misty, that's okay. You know.
Speaking of getting misty. 20 years later.
Oh, yeah, 20.
You are now turning to the resurrection.
That's it. Yeah, the resurrection now.
Where are we? Where are you?
I mean, it's kind of pre-production stage now, and we're definitely on it. It is my focus, and you know, it will happen. Things, it's like childbirth, you know? It's like, it's been 20 years, and it's like, it was an idea I had, you know, to do the next part a long time ago, but it's been a very long labor.
Why do you think it's taken all this time?
Because it's supposed to take all that time. And there's something, it is telling me how and when, and I've just placed its development and its formation in the hands of Providence.
I was just about to ask you, do you think it's providential the way this is unfolded?
I think so.
The timing of it.
And the timing is not my timing, but it is timing, and I think there's something bigger at play here. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm just going to try and just ride that and take, you know, pry my own fingers off the steering wheel and let Providence take a hand.
This is sort of what happened with The Passion. I mean, it went its own way as you were doing it.
That's right, yes. It just had its own kind of journey. I was merely a component, merely an instrument, you know, and I'm trying to be that again and not think I'm bigger than my boots or anything else. I just want to be of service in telling this story the best way it can possibly be told, to entertain, to educate, and to enlighten people, to lift them, you know, and this is what I want to do with it, you know.
Yeah, well, all your work does that.
Yeah, oh, let's hope so, yeah.
Thank you, Mel.
Thanks, man.
Great.
Cheers.
Mel Gibson's new film, Flight Risk, starring Mark Wahlberg, is in theaters now. That is all the time we have for now, but be sure to catch us next week. Until then, we'll be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, thank you for watching. I'm Raymond Arroyo. Bye now.